Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for March 18th. Up first is Ian Garner and Taras Kuzio writing on why Mariupol's fate lays bare Putin's fascist ambitions.
Nearly eight decades since the defeat of Nazism, the West again faces the specter of fascism in Europe. 2 years after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Vladimir Putin's regime, freshly victorious in the country's latest sham election, is using the brutal destruction and rapid regeneration of the Ukrainian city of Mariupol as a showpiece for a new fascist Russia. In an era when accusing opponents of fascism is commonplace across the political divide in the West, we as authors do not deploy the term fascism lightly. To do so risks devaluing the term. Yet by considering what fascism really is and exploring the fate of Mariupol, we can show that today's Russia really does have fascist ambitions. Fascist states view the existing world as decadent, corrupt, and diseased, a far cry from their romanticized utopian past, when the nation in question supposedly lived harmoniously, cleanly, and with unimpeded international power. For fascists, the world must be transformed through violent, revolutionary action, the total destruction of the disease that has infected the nation. Fascist nations demand an enemy, for it is only through obliterating that enemy that they can rejuvenate themselves. Thus, in the fascist imagination, everyone from politicians to ordinary people is wrapped up in an existential battle to save the spirit of the nation. The end, saving civilization, justifies any means. And the evidence shows that ordinary Russians are buying into the state's vision. Of course, the promise of rejuvenation through destruction is absurd and illogical. It is doomed to failure, for it cannot resolve real social, political, or structural problems. One enemy must be viciously attacked and then another one immediately targeted. This most extreme of political systems, as the Italian philosopher Umberto Eco put it, therefore finds itself in a state of permanent warfare. It is increasingly clear that Putin's Russia is a fascist nation. Barely a year of the 24 years Russia has spent under Putin has gone by without war. Against Chechnya, against Georgia, against Ukraine, against ethnic and sexual minorities at home, and, of course, against the West. But Putin does not wage war for geopolitical reasons. He wages war because he hopes through conflict to regenerate his own nation. Putin, like the fascists Hitler and Benito Mussolini did 80 years ago, seeks to purify his own country through the destruction of Ukraine. A state that he views as both a false construction that has never and can never exist, and as a land of Russians deformed by exposure to Western decadence. Putin is ready to obliterate Ukraine and Ukrainians to cleanse Russia. Nowhere is that better exemplified than in the horrifying treatment meted out to Mariupol, which was once a bustling city and regional hub in southeastern Ukraine. For 2 months during spring 2022, Mariupol's civilians and buildings were subjected to a brutal military bombardment and campaign of terror. The city was all but destroyed. Estimates vary regarding the number of civilian casualties, but the death toll in Mariupol is nonetheless staggering, from nearly 10,000 to potentially many times that number. Many who survived were deported to Russia through filtration camps where they suffered torture and humiliation and, in some cases, disappeared. They were forcibly separated from their children, tens of thousands of whom were sent to orphanages in Russia where they were put up for adoption by strangers. Russian propagandists and politicians welcomed the destruction of Mariupol with glee, embracing the obliteration of both the city and its population. Russian state television egged on Mariupol's destruction, describing Ukraine as a cancerous growth that needs to be eliminated all the way to the border with Poland. We can't allow even a small part of it to remain. Vladimir Putin confirmed that destruction was a natural and necessary self-purification of the society that will only strengthen our country. Mariupol's obliteration was not a regrettable strategic decision. It was healing a cancer, and thus purifying Russia itself. Today, Russia is attempting to recreate Mariupol and its residents as an idealized pastiche of the motherland. 18 months after the city's capture, Putin met local schoolchildren via video link to mark the new school year in 2023. The Russian president invited Anastasia, a teenage pupil from Mariupol, to speak. She anxiously read her lines. "My dreams, the dreams of every child in Mariupol and Donetsk, are becoming reality because we've become part of the great motherland, Russia, once more." Anastasia's staged performance seems absurd, but it encapsulates Russia's fascist ambition. The destruction of Mariupol is directly linked to the rebuilding of a greater Russian empire, with Putin following Peter the Great and Joseph Stalin into the hallowed annals of Russian history, and with ordinary citizens finding their dreams are becoming reality. On the ground, every aspect of life in Mariupol is being transformed to write the city into Russian history and to purify its inhabitants of their Ukrainian identity. Since Mariupol's destruction, the Russian state has poured billions of rubles into reconstruction. Vast new apartment complexes have sprung up at lightning speed. Russia's state-owned media have hailed the destruction of Mariupol and the rejuvenation of Russia at every step of the way, relishing the chance to publish before and after images of the destroyed city and its newly rebuilt, improved self. That new Mariupol, though, is no ordinary city. The Russian occupiers have taken every opportunity to erase all traces of Ukrainian nationality and identity from it. Symbolically, one of the first acts the new regime undertook after seizing the city was to replace the large sign at the city limits, once decked out in Ukrainian national colors and written in Ukrainian script, with a new sign written in Russian and colored red, white, and blue. Since then, symbols of Russian national identity, both Tsarist and Soviet, have flooded the cityscape. Mariupol's drama theater, the scene of a particularly vicious bombing that killed at least a dozen people, was covered with billboards depicting Russian writers. New monuments to Russian military and religious heroes like Alexander Nevsky and the Metropolitan Ignaty have sprung up. A museum dedicated to Andrei Zhdanov, the Stalinist ideologue after whom Mariupol was named during the Soviet era, has been planned. Everywhere citizens of Mariupol look, they find Ukrainianness obliterated and, in its place, signs of Russia's glorious past. Again, Putin led the way in promoting these efforts, even traveling to the city on a rare visit to the front. On the Day of National Unity, which marks Russia's military victory over Polish invaders in the 17th century, the president declared Mariupol is a very famous, ancient, one might say Russian city. Of course, the people and their homes suffered terribly there. "We need to rebuild housing, social infrastructure, kindergartens, libraries, theaters, and museums." Putin, not surprisingly, forgot to mention Mariupol's new inhabitants would be from Russia. A program to entice Russians to move to Mariupol and Russify the town imitates the Nazi plan of Lebensraum, or living space, under which Germans would be encouraged to colonize lands inhabited by Slavs, albeit today Russians are attracted to Mariupol with the promise of cheap apartments and new opportunities in flashy YouTube real estate videos. Those Ukrainian residents who remain are expected to reinvent themselves as Russians. Children are encouraged and often forced to participate in mandatory national patriotism classes, state paramilitary youth groups, and rituals that celebrate the so-called special military operation as following in the footsteps of their ancestors in the Great Patriotic War in fighting Nazis, this time in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russian propaganda channels brandish children taken from Mariupol to Russia as evidence that Moscow's war is saving the future of both Ukraine and Russia itself. In Putin's macabre dystopian world, Mariupol and the people of Mariupol had to perish so that Russia could be reborn. The state hails the volunteers who have rushed to assist in schools, on construction projects, and with humanitarian aid. The city, as one state journalist wrote to accompany a photographic tour of Mariupol, has risen like a phoenix from the ashes. Believe the Russians in Mariupol's story is one of life, not death. The cult of war has pervaded Putin's nearly quarter of a century rule over Russia. Myth mingles with reality. The celebration of war, especially the sacrifices made in the Second World War, has become more religion than memorial. In this world, Mariupol is a modern-day Stalingrad, the city whose total destruction, according to the Russian myth, signaled the rebirth of Russia as a great power and empire. And as with the Battle of Stalingrad, when dictator Joseph Stalin sacrificed a million of his troops before turning the tide, death is an essential precursor to new life. In the Russia of today, to borrow Orwell's line from 1984, war is peace. Freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. Only destruction, in the Putinist faith, can bring about regeneration. But we know that this is an absurd, impossible promise. As the Kremlin drags its own people ever downward and continues its assault on Ukraine, it is obvious that war cannot rejuvenate Russia. Today, Mariupol may be hailed as the source of national spiritual energy. But tomorrow, another country, another neighbor, another ethnic group, or another minority at home must become the target for obliteration. As with the fascist regimes of the past, Putin's regime will continue the dystopian cycle of destruction and regeneration until it is militarily defeated.
That was a commentary by Ian Garner and Taras Kuzio. Ian Garner is a specialist in Russian culture and war propaganda at Queen's University, and Taras Kuzio is a professor in the Department of Political Science, National University of Kyiv Mola Academy. You can find the full text of their article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is by Aaron Gash Burnett, writing on why Canada should start seizing Russian assets as a way of becoming a global leader.
Amidst embarrassing delays to Canada's military equipment shipments to Ukraine, there is a bright light of Canadian leadership in support of Kyiv's fight against an invading Russia. Canada is currently one of only two countries and the only one in the G7 to have drafted legislation to seize Russia's central bank reserves. Over $400 billion Canadian dollars of these assets have been sitting in Western accounts since they were frozen 2 years ago. Since then, the Russians haven't been able to access them, but they also haven't been able to be used for anything else. Yet even as Canada and other foreign countries confiscated the private assets of Russian oligarchs, Russia's state assets have remained immune from such seizure. That's changing under an amendment to Canadian sanctions law, finally allowing the government to confiscate Russia's state assets. Current estimates are that $19 billion Canadian dollars lie frozen in either Canadian accounts or those associated with Euroclear Bank in Belgium. Canada could take this money and give it to Ukraine for liberation or reconstruction. This would prove useful, given that Russia has inflicted more than $650 billion Canadian dollars in damage on Ukraine so far, and is unlikely to pay reparations for its crimes. At a time when Western taxpayers are being asked to provide more support for Ukraine amidst the rising cost of living, it's also unconscionable to leave dirty Russian money on the table. Now, more than ever, the world's democracies must work together to ensure Ukraine is victorious. And we must ensure the aggressor pays, says Catherine Kuplinskas, press secretary to Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland. Canada has long advocated for unlocking and using Russia's central bank assets to support Ukraine's fight against Putin's war machine and fund the long-term reconstruction. Unfortunately, it's not clear when the Trudeau government intends to actually use this law. Western government sources say G7 countries, including Canada, the US, and the UK, which are in favor of seizing Russian assets, don't want to actually do it until all G7 countries agree. Freeland has been busy meeting with her allied counterparts in the background, yet neither she nor Minister of Foreign Affairs Melanie Jo Lee have had much to say publicly about when Canada will actually use its world-leading law, or whether they intend to use it to help convince allies to seize Russian assets within their own borders. The problem with waiting for G7 agreement is that allies like Germany have needed to be consistently pressured and shamed before providing necessary support for Ukraine, whether it was canceling the Nord Stream 2 pipeline just before the full-scale invasion, or finally sending Leopard 2 tanks after months of dithering. France and Germany are also reluctant to seize Russian state assets, with German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock ruling it out at a recent EU summit, arguing it would violate international law. If Canada really wants to help Ukraine win, it needs to be willing to make allied laggards look bad. Waiting for G7 agreement before acting will simply allow reluctant European governments to keep putting off decisions to seize Russian assets. Someone has to be bold enough to act first. This time, it needs to be us. Firstly, given the sorry state of our military equipment, Canadian legislative leadership around assets offers us the best possible shot at helping Ukraine win right now. Canada is also a country that still enjoys an excellent reputation among both European elites and the European public. Given the United States' current reputation in Europe, Europeans are sometimes inclined to dismiss American policy initiatives. Canada's reputation as a moral leader makes it more difficult to ignore. Second, waiting is a luxury we don't have. Waiting to make this move risks financially starving Ukraine and risks its ultimate defeat, says Yulia Zyskina, a senior legal fellow for the pro-Ukraine nonprofit Razum Advocacy, whom the Canadian government consulted with on its recent amendment to sanctions law. Ukraine cannot afford to wait. Its survival is at risk. But real Canadian leadership will require diplomatic capital. For that, Canada's talented diplomats need the political green light from the very top. The overall direction on this should be coming from Ministers Freeland and Joe Lee. But neither of them have been very outspoken on Ukraine lately, says Chris Alexander, Canada's former Minister of Citizenship and Immigration. He's also served as a Conservative MP and Minister Counselor at the Canadian Embassy in Moscow. Diplomats need a clear expression of political will, a clear statement of purpose, not necessarily public, that says, we are going to get this done, then is willing to expend political effort to break logjams when they occur. My conversations with Canadian diplomats also leave me concerned that Canadian leaders have yet to give an explicit green light to push allied countries to seize Russian assets. More than two-thirds of Russia's frozen central bank reserves sit in Europe. If the Canadian government only intends to seize the Russian assets in its own jurisdiction, without following it up with a diplomatic strategy for convincing our allies to do the same, we will miss a significant opportunity to help Ukraine and demonstrate the global leadership we keep telling ourselves we still have. It's time to break with the comfortable habit we have of being a follower. Canada needs to come out of G7 back rooms and make the asset seizure case boldly in public. We need to not be afraid to lead by acting first. Ukraine and history would thank us for it.
That was a commentary by Aaron Gash-Burnett. He is a German-Canadian journalist and security analyst based in Berlin. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.